Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Ramon, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Ramon. I'm a sex med gynecologist, a menopause expert in downtown Chicago. And I'm super excited today. We're going to do like kind of a review episode, but also like some frequently asked questions because today is my 100th episode. Yay! And I have my sidekick, Karen Bradley, yes. One of my biggest supporters and friends here. We're in the office and I was just talking to her about it. And I was like, let's talk about, you know, some of the stuff that's been happening and some of the successes we've had. And we're going to review some of the questions that we get asked and some of the themes that have come up in the past 100 episodes. But it's a big landmark. I mean, honestly, there have been times that I've wanted to just stop doing this because I didn't think it was relevant. And then we'll get a patient or someone DM me like, oh, heard this on your podcast or thanks for all that you're doing. And so that does give me life to continue to do this. And I'm so happy to have Karen here as, you know, a great support. And also she's also building her social media platform to get more information out there.
Yeah.
You guys have heard her before on my podcast. And so today I just want to thank everyone, thank the listeners. You know what? I'm super excited that, you know, things, I mean, I'm not like, you know, Mel Robbins or anything. Although I'm willing to get, you know, if anybody wants to sponsor me, I'm up for it. But you know what? Hopefully, you know, it's making impact and, you know, I'm going to continue to be out here educating because there's a lot of misinformation out there that we need to make sure that we're debunking. But 100 episodes is kind of a big deal.
Yeah,
so I feel like
let's, definitely a big deal.
But, you know, Karen, I was thinking we should talk about this big landmark thing that happened in the last few weeks. And that is, you know, we all have political opinions about what's happening with our government.
Yeah.
But when we have a win, we should talk about the win.
Yep.
And, you know, the FDA removed their box warning off of estrogen. At least that proposal has gone through. Now, the next steps are really like whether or not, you know, the different pharmaceutical groups are going to include it. But just as a review, like a boxed warning, they used to call it the black box warning, but we call it a boxed warning because it's literally a box. And it basically is a warning of the most serious side effects. And this warning has always said that estrogens can cause breast cancer, can cause uterine cancer, can cause colon cancer, can cause pulmonary embolus, can cause deep venous thrombosis, so blood clots, can cause dementia, can cause heart attacks, can cause death. So, like, you know, you have someone, we know statistically, like if a woman's given vaginal estrogen, for example, which we do a lot of in this office, and you send them home with a prescription, 30% of the patients are not going to use that prescription because they're going to open the label and they're going to see the boxed warning. So, and then, you know, or their significant other will and be like, you know what, the sex is not that important. I don't want to lose you because you're using a product that might cause you to die or have cancer or something like that. And so, I think that we see it all the time. We tell our patients, like, don't read the box warning. Don't read this. But, you know, some people can't help it. And it becomes an us versus them. Like, we're telling you one thing, but the pharmaceutical company or the FDA is telling you something else.
Right. It labeled all forms of estrogen the same.
The same, which, you know, I think it was in 2014 is when the term genital urinary syndrome menopause was adapted to include urinary symptoms as well as vaginal changes. But it was in 2016 or 17 that organizations like ISHWISH, the Menopause Society, ACOG, all these people, you know, initially came to the FDA and said, hey, listen, this warning is not fair, particularly for vaginal estrogen. This is a not fair warning. We should not have this warning on vaginal estrogen. And you know, we didn't get anywhere. The truth of the matter is, it wasn't until social media and advocacy groups like Let's Talk Menopause and some of us that are getting really loud on our platforms that have pushed the FDA into making this decision. Starting in July, they had a roundtable discussion with some of my friends and colleagues. And then this last 2 weeks ago in November, they met and said, this is what they're going to do. And so it's really a big moment. I didn't get to go because I was down to ISHWISH, but it was a big moment for women's health and women's history. So no matter where you are on the political spectrum, and we know that the government's not doing great things for women in other arenas, we have to count this as a big win because it's gonna reduce the amount of barriers to getting estrogen products, and it's gonna help women in the long run. And there's some concern about this sometimes because now it seems like they're gonna remove the label off of all estrogens. And so we have to think about why they put the label on in the first place. It kind of dates back. You guys have heard us all talk about the Women's Health Initiative. The Women's Health Initiative was the big landmark study that was looking at whether or not estrogen is for primary prevention of heart disease, particularly because, you know, back in the day, there were some studies that seemed to correlate and seem to deduce that if you take estrogen, you would reduce the rate of heart disease for women, which, you know, did not pan out with the Women's Health Initiative and still is not given for primary prevention, although we do know there's some cardiovascular benefits. And so with the Women's Health Initiative, it was, you know, a study that was done to look at primary prevention. It was stopped prematurely in 2002 because there was a slight uptick in breast cancer that was actually, you know, I remember reading the study. I remember what happened. You know, we were like, what's the big deal? It was like, you know, a relative increase in risk. The women on average were 63 years old, and the risk was more associated with the people that were on the progestogen, medroxyprogesterone acetate, not the estrogen alone, which seemed to have a reduction in breast cancer. Well, this all is the reason that, you know, the box warning was first put on. And so now the pendulum is swinging to the other side, and some people have concerns that there should still be a warning on estrogen. Now, just because the box warning is coming off, if you look at the FDA and some of the stakeholder calls that have been done, it doesn't mean that the warnings are not still going to be there. There's still going to be a warning, especially about endometrial cancer and use of estrogen without progesterone.
Mm-hmm.
There's still going to be warnings about, you know, the timing hypothesis, you know, starting it within 10 years is going to be more beneficial than starting it 10 years after, potentially. But doesn't mean you can't. It just really comes down to a nuanced discussion and an individual discussion around the use of menopausal hormonal therapy for perimenopause and postmenopause. And so I think at the end of the day, it's putting the onus back on the clinicians. We have to be the ones to
monitor.
Yes. And to have these discussions with our patients, who if we sit and you have time to educate your patient, you know, women are smart. They can make decisions. There's bodily autonomy. We have bodily autonomy. We can make a shared decision with our clinician and say, you know what? I've looked at the risks. I've looked at the benefits. To me, everything has a risk and benefit. I'm going to take the risk and see if I get a benefit, right? So it is shared decision. It is back in the hands of the clinicians where it should have been all along. And it's hopefully going to be a roadblock that patients don't have to experience. Because I can tell you, as someone who's been, we've been prescribing this for a long time to patients, we have pharmacies that have called us, you know, oh, she can't use this because she has heart disease. She can't use this because she has a family history of this or that. You know, because of the box warning, people stop thinking for themselves and stop being nuanced, and they just do reflexively what the box warning says, right? So I think this gives us an opportunity to really provide precision medicine the way we should have been doing it all along, the way many of us have been doing it all along. But the roadblocks are there. I'll give you an example of a way that this has changed. Karen and I have a patient who has a history of LCIS, like a pre-invasive tumor of the breast, and was treated for it and was remote from it and was having significant hot flashes, night sweats, sleep disturbance, weight gain. Yeah. And she had gone to her oncology group and her surgeon 2 months before she saw us, like, please, the SSRIs aren't working. The, you know, non-hormonal methods are not working. I need help. Can you give me menopausal hormone therapy? I've read books like Estrogen Matters. I've listened to podcasts. I think that I'm okay taking it based on what I know. And her surgeon and the team at the time told her no. She found us. She came to us. We talked to her about, like, Duave, which is anti-estrogen at your breast and your uterus. And also she wanted to try oral micronized progesterone and a transdermal estrogen patch, which she took for about a month after, before seeing her oncology group again, who she saw last week, actually. And she texted us that, number one, she feels great. Like, she feels like her, you know, her life is coming back to her, that she's starting to feel more like herself. Number two, she said, "I finally got the guts to tell my breast surgeon what I was doing." And the breast surgeon made a full about face and told her, "I'm so glad you're doing this." I don't know if I told you this, because I talked to her last. "I'm so glad you're doing this. I'm so glad that this is happening, because now the box warning," and she said, "the box warning is off now, so I'm not as worried as I was before, because it looks like the data's been looked at very closely and we don't have to fear as much." And that is her oncology breast surgeon team. So that is case in point about how that box warning inhibited patients from getting the help that they need. So that's all I wanted to say about that. What do you think about that? Anything else you wanted to
No,
add?
I think it's great, but I also think that, her surgical team should have done more research on
Yeah.
their own and,
Yes.
individually to
Yes.
help make their decision with her, personally, so that they can do what's best for her. And I know, they're trying to do their best, but
Right.
we all have to educate ourselves as
Yes.
medical professionals to make the best choices because, yes, you want to make sure, your cancer risks are low, but you don't want to just exist. You don't want to suffer, if you
Right. Yeah.
can provide a better quality of life.
Right.
And I think
If
that they could have done a little more instead of just shutting her down.
right.
Look at the data yourself,
Look at
read
that.
through the studies,
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the reality is, like, she has a lot of cardiovascular risks, because she's having all these hot flashes and night sweats, and she's not sleeping, which is making her cardiovascular risk worse.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
heart disease still kills women more than breast cancer. So, are we trading one morbidity mortality for another? That was, a question that we had to ask ourselves. And so I'm just so glad that she's doing better. And I'm so glad that we have a win for women's health. No matter where you stand on the political spectrum, I'm not someone that has loved a lot of what this administration's done for women's health, but I'm going to accept this win and I'm going to say, you know what? Let's just keep moving forward and keep educating women the way we need to. Well, that's all I wanted to say about that. And thank you for your input too, Karen. I think I do want to say one other thing about that. And I think I don't think either one of us want to vilify other clinicians, but
No.
we know that the reality of our healthcare system is that it's broken, that we're set up to fail our patients and we're set up to fail ourselves, which is why, we were so, even though, the change is always difficult, we were very happy to start our concierge model, because we know that the 10-minute, the 15-minute patient visit
It doesn't work.
doesn't work. And it doesn't work for patients, it doesn't work for clinicians, And in those same structures, we can't educate ourselves. We can't learn the data because we don't have time for it. And the patient, and we don't have time to explain it to the patient. So this is just another pitch for really nuanced medicine that has to be done usually outside of the system, I think. Don't you think?
I agree.
And so I think that that's one important factor. I want to just go over some of the questions that I had looked at and what people come to us asking a lot, or they basically like will DM us or other questions. And one of the biggest ones I think we hear all the time is like, is this perimenopause or is this just stress? Like, what is it? And the truth is, like, it's probably both.
Yeah,
Like,
it's probably a combination of both.
yeah, and I think we always say that women in midlife, they're at this like pinnacle of things happening to them, right? They have maybe stuff happening with their career if they're career people. They might have stuff happening with parents. They might have stuff happening with kids. They might have stuff happening with other friends and family members or dogs or whatever. And as caregivers, we carry the brunt of a lot of that for a lot of our family, a lot of our friends, a lot of our patients. And so if you have so much stress in your life and you sprinkle in a little bit of a roller coaster of estrogen, like 1 month is high, 1 month is low, which modulates, everything happening in our brain, then of course, like, it's not going to be one of these things that's easy to manage. And I think, whatever bandwidth you used to have is less as we age and as we go through this transition. So that question, is this all perimenopause, Karen?
No, it's not all. It is, I think it's a combination. Definitely a combination. I mean, and perimenopause can exacerbate what you're going through on a daily basis. So you need to get a hold of it to make things a little more manageable so you can cope.
I mean, the truth is, we all know patients who have a history of anxiety or a history of depression or have postpartum depression. Let's not discount what happens in our pregnancy because those things are really, risk factors for what might happen in the perimenopausal transition. So if you're someone that had, anxiety postpartum or postpartum depression, then guess what? We got to get on top of this before you hit perimenopause.
Exactly.
Because this is another time of hormonal flux, and we have to actually be on top of what's happening so that, we're not caught blindsided, right? We have patients who have
Exactly.
anxiety, and guess what?
It is very difficult initially for them to manage that when they're going through perimenopause without hormone replacement therapy. And we kind of help to balance things out so that life is tolerable and happy and, you can function.
You can function, yeah. Because we all have to be functional and we have, but not only functional, we need to actually like not suffer, I think. And so I think that, when you think about your own self and, if you had the privilege and honor or not honor, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, getting pregnant. If you were able to get pregnant and you experienced a pregnancy and you had issues around that pregnancy, whether it's high blood pressure, diabetes, or any of the mood disorders, we have to know that those things can come
Circle
and
back.
circle back in another time of hormonal flux, and that is perimenopause. So if you're one of those people, think about what you're doing with your lifestyle right now that can benefit you in that perimenopausal transition, because that's something that we always see. Another thing that we always get asked, or someone will DM us about, is about libido. Is this,
No, yes.
Oh, every doctor I say this is normal for my age. Every doctor I tell me that, oh, the midlife low libido is just something that we all go through and is a part of natural aging. And that's not entirely true either. I think that libido is very complicated. So again, when you think about all the things that we're dealing with in this time of our lives, sex goes on the back burner for most people, right? If you ask me, sex or sleep?
Sleep.
Sleep every single day. Every single day. Because like that's just the reality of like I think where you're at in life and dealing with all the stressors. And of course, stress makes you less able to cope with sort of the sleep. Hot flashes, night sweats, don't make you feel sexy. That midsection weight gain, the hair loss, all the things that you might experience in this perimenopausal transition make you less and less desiring, this part of your life.
Diminish your desire.
Diminish your desire. And I think that, we know that testosterone naturally starts to decline in your 30s. So there's biological plausibility too for that. It's not always just in your head, or it's not always just, what's happening around you. Which is why people have historically been told, what, go have some wine, relax, go get some yoga, all the stuff. There's biology to it too, right? When your testosterone starts trending down after you're 30, we have changes happening in our neurotransmitters. This testosterone is regulating your dopamine and your norepinephrine, which are all regulators of your sexual function. And guess what? When these things start changing, so does your desire. And the truth is, we've talked about this before, but women don't experience a linear desire. Like it's not the old Masters and Johnsons, you go from excitation to orgasm. That's not how it works for women. We have a circular paradigm. It's an incentive-based paradigm for a sexual desire. Rosemary Bessant, I've talked about this before, but for us, it's really an incentive-based desire. So sometimes you have to get aroused before you have a desire. It's not spontaneous. It's responsive for most people, especially in long-term relationships. I think I've said this before, but like at our last Ishwish meeting, We had the amazing Laurie Mintz, who I have to have back on this podcast. She's amazing. She is a sex therapist in Florida and has written the books on Tired Woman's Guide to Passionate Sex and Being Clitorate. I think it's called Being Clitorate. Anyway, she wrote the books. She's a sex therapist, and she asked the question to the audience, how many of you have sex because you're horny? And, you know, nobody raises their hand. And she said, this is a pretty typical response for women, especially in long-term relationships, mm-hmm. that the reason most people have sex with their partner is because
obligation.
Yes. Or, you know, you feel bad. You don't want them mm-hmm. to feel bad. Oh, you know what? I really want to have a girl's trip. If I do this, maybe he'll play. So, you know, libido does change. There is a biologic reason for it. There's also psychosocial causes. And that's why sexual dysfunction is treated through a biopsychosocial lens. I think the statistic is, if you ask women, you know, if they what is their most common form of sexual dysfunction, it is still libido. It's like 1 in 10 women, I think. But, you know, like up to 40% of women might say they have low libido, but maybe they're not bothered, right? So hypoactive sexual desire disorder is really low libido with bother. Like, you have to mm-hmm. have a frustration or bother by it. Because some people, like, they okay. have partners.
Yeah, they have partners that, unfortunately, are they also going through. So it works for them. You know, well, and you if it's not a problem, then, you know.
Right. But, you know.
Like, the other half that have, you know, where it's affecting their marriage, you know, we need to address that.
We need to address that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it usually is looking at any causes of pain, looking at your medications, looking at what's happening in your life, looking at your relationship, looking at all the things. We always say, like, you know, if you hate your husband.
Exactly.
No medication I give you.
Can't fix it.
We don't do husband replacement therapy.
Exactly. Nope.
No, that's not the HRT that we do. Anyway. Okay. So another thing we get asked a lot is UTIs after sex, right? Like, this is a common thing for young patients. This is a common thing for, you know, midlife patients and beyond. And so we know that, you know, it is common for a lot of people. Some people are more susceptible based on, you know, the type of bacteria they may house, they might get exposed to. But for women that are experiencing hormonal fluctuations, and whether or not that's postpartum, whether or not that's from being on birth control pills, whether or not that's, you know, perimenopause, we know that the genital urinary tract can be affected. That's the genital urinary syndrome of menopause, of lactation, of being the hormonally mediated vestibulodynia related to birth control pills, whatever the case. The vulvar vaginal skin starts to change when we have a deficiency of estrogen and androgens, that is the testosterone. So hormonal suppression from birth control pills, for instance, mm-hmm. which affects, you know, anywhere from like 1 to 5% of the population, depending on where you're reading it, can have a change in the vulvar vestibule, the opening of the vagina, that becomes thinner, that becomes more red, becomes more inflamed. And the vulvar vestibule, the top part of it is around the urethra. So a lot of the symptoms that women experience, the burning when they pee, the urinary frequency urgency, is not from a UTI, actually. It's mm-hmm. from this vestibulodynia, the pain in the vestibule from lack of local hormone therapy. And so that's one way we can assess people that have symptoms, or they feel like they have recurrent UTIs and their culture's coming back negative. Or some patients actually are getting recurrent UTIs, and that's because in this area, the vulvovaginal microbiome changes because of the genital urinary syndrome menopause. Estrogen allows for acidity in the vagina. When that changes, it becomes more basic. People have a change in their microbiome. The vaginal microbiome is very important. You get this change, you get a new exposure. You know, the distance from the vagina to the urethra is even smaller. You get more frequent UTIs. And UTIs, you know, in midlife women and beyond, 60-year-old, 70-year-old, 80-year-old women, they get UTIs. They can actually develop urosepsis, mm-hmm. and they can end up in the ICU, or they can die. And so that's why giving women vaginal estrogen or vaginal DHEA not only it's not a matter of just vaginal dryness, it's not a matter of just painful sex, it's not a matter of just being more comfortable. It's actually life saving for women. So that's one of the easiest ways we can save lives, give some vaginal estrogen. So I think that's something we have to always remember, and would be one of my take home messages that I like to give my patients. You know, and I think one of the other questions that we always get asked, or that we've been asked, or that gets talked about the most when we see our patients, is really around what's happening with their body, right? I think so much of, you know, this weight gain, this midsection weight gain. We've done a lot of podcasts on, you know, weight changes, visceral fat accumulation. That's that fat around those organs. And so that's always the question that'll come up. Like, why is this happening to me? Like, what is happening with my weight gain? Like, how can I stop this from, you know, continuing? I have had a perfect diet. I eat clean. Like, this is 100% like a change for me. I don't know how to make it better. And so I think it's really, we always start with, you know, like, tell us what you're doing. Right? Like, tell us
what's your diet? What's your exercise routine? Just what are your habits, your sleep habits, everything? Because it can make a difference. Sometimes people don't realize what they're doing or not doing. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes people are doing everything right and the weight is just stuck there. They're like, I haven't changed anything. What is happening to me?
And we see that a lot also with, you know, like PCOS patients or patients in, like, again, the perimenopause, midlife. And it's a lot of it is hormonally mediated. We do believe that, you know, these fluctuations, you know, cause, you know, this inflammatory response in the viscera. And so, you know, people do come to us for hormones thinking that they're going to help. The reality is, I think the majority of people, you know, if they're having hot flashes, night sweats, or sleep disturbance, and you treat those, because we know disruptive sleep is also associated with visceral fat accumulation. So if we're treating those three things, and somebody, those are the patients that might say they've had change, like they can see changes back into their weight because they've used hormones. But the majority of patients probably, you know, might not have any further gains, but they're not necessarily going to lose weight when they start hormones. And so they still have to really tweak their protein intake, increase their fiber intake, and work on
strength training.
Yeah. That muscle, right? Like, we had the episode with Dr. Vonda White, right? And we had Mary Claire Haver, some of them talking about all these weight changes and building muscle and making sure that we're doing that so that we can, you know, burn the calories during the day, you know, build more muscle and replace the fat. But also, you know, sometimes people need extra help, and these medications that people use for weight loss, the GLP-1s, have, I think, revolutionized how people are dealing with their weight. And when the book Ozempic Revolution came out by Alexandra Sowa, I did have her on the podcast, and she talked about a lot of this. But, you know, some of these women really benefit from these medications, and they're making a big difference in quality of life, but also, you know, cardiovascular risks, obstructive sleep apnea. So just to review, like, so when you have the brand name Ozempic and Mounjaro, those are semaglutide and tirzepatide, and they're FDA approved for diabetes.
Right.
So when it, just to remind you, when it comes to these GLP-1s, these glucagon-like peptides, these incretins, as they're called, the brand names of Mounjaro and Ozempic are for the treatment of type 2 diabetes for FDA approval. Doesn't mean you can't take it outside of FDA approval, but it won't get covered by insurance. And then when you talk about Wegovy, which is semaglutide, that is for weight loss, and usually covered for a BMI greater than 30 or greater than 27 with two comorbid conditions like hypertension or cholesterol. And it's also recently been approved for metabolic associated steatohepatitis or MASH. And so people can be screened for that and get approved for that medication and get it covered by insurance. We also know that it's shown some cardiovascular benefits, which tirzepatide hasn't
No, it
shown
hasn't been proven yet.
demonstrated. And so this is a reduction in major adverse cardiovascular events by 20%. That's pretty huge. So that's like a big thing. And that's with Wegovy, which is semaglutide. And then you compare that to Zepbound, which is tirzepatide. And that is a GLP and a GIP. And so patients may tolerate it better. Some people don't have the same GI side effects, but it seems that that one is still only for.
It's for weight loss and treatment of OSA, obstructive sleep
Yes.
apnea.
Right. So tirzepatide slash Zepbound is FDA approved for weight loss with the same indications just described, but also.
For obstructive sleep apnea.
Yes. So those are the FDA approved indications. We know it has benefits outside of that. We know patients like PCOS do really well with it. We know patients with
Inflammatory condition.
inflammatory conditions seem to have some benefit. I've talked about the patients that I've had that have PGAD because it works on your GLP receptors in your brain that is really responsible for that dopaminergic response. I've had patients that when I think about the region-based approach for persistent genital arousal disorder or genital pelvic dysesthesias, there's some patients that have that benefit as well for region five, if we think those arousal tendencies are coming from region five. We've done episodes on PGAD as well, which have gone really well with April Patterson, and I've talked about PGAD myself and some patients who have had it. So those are other episodes that we've done. We've done episodes on the GLP medications and obesity medicine. We've done a lot of perimenopause, menopause. We've done a lot of sexual dysfunction, sex therapy, pelvic floor PT. So there's a lot that we've covered this year, and I'm super excited. I'm gonna have every time I do a episode in the office, Karen will join me. She's gonna be my sidekick in the office, and we're gonna do a couple of other episodes, that are gonna be videotaped for next year. So you guys should stay tuned. But Karen, what do you think? Anything else you wanted to add about any of the stuff that we've been doing?
I think you did a pretty good job covering most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
My frequent
oh, and
questions.
then we do a lot about cultural understanding. I had a great episode with Janine Anderson, and we talked about intersectionality, and we talked about women of color and some experiences of Black women specifically based on her research. And I had also Dr. Mobeen Saeed, who talked about South Asians and their cardiovascular risk and how it's in our genetics. Yeah, we just a lot of interesting stuff we covered. We've covered some religious stuff. So, you guys can, look back at that. But I think we've had a couple of good 100 good episodes, and hopefully the next 100 will be even better. So if you have suggestions of ways to make it better, if you have things that you think that I need to be doing differently, maybe cutting my intro a little bit, maybe doing other things, please suggest. I do like to read comments. I may not always respond. Try not to troll me though, because those affect me a lot. Sometimes I get trolled on YouTube and I'm like, why did she say that about my hair? I don't get it. Why? And I sit with it for too long. So, try not to troll me because, it hurts. It hurts. I'm a person.
Yes, it hurts. It hurts for sure. I would say one takeaway I would want all women to think of is just if things are changing, say something. If you feel something, don't just ignore it, bring it up. And if your initial provider is not, they're dismissing it or something, seek someone else.
Yes.
Do not suffer. You do not have to.
Absolutely. And as Dr. Sharon Malone, who I also had on this podcast, says quite frequently that menopause is inevitable if you're lucky enough to live
Right.
long enough, but suffering is not.
Exactly.
So we'll leave you that statement by the wise Dr. Sharon Malone, who is an amazing OBGYN and menopause advocate, who I had on the podcast as well. But yeah, and just remember, I'm here to educate so you could advocate for yourself. Go out there, learn something, send it out in the world, share the episodes, and give us ideas about what you want to hear. If you want to hear from patients, I have a lot of patients who have great stories that they're willing to tell in an anonymous or non-anonymous way. But yeah, just let us know, and we're happy to accommodate any ideas. All right. Thanks, guys. See you back next week. Please like and subscribe. And thanks for joining us for another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. We'll see you next time.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.